if she comes back. But if there's no way of moving back, what when your face falls apart? Have you got enough time?
From the land of the sky and to high strangers around the globe, this is Joshua P. Warren's Speaking of Strange, hosted by Vance Pollock.
And the world is becoming more and more insane every day. Welcome to the program that gives you breaking news and insight into the paranormal and downright weird, where the unusual becomes usual. And we don't just discuss it, we go into the field to investigate. I'm your host, Vance Pollock, on behalf of Joshua P. Warren, in the studio with Miss Shelley Wright. How are you, Shelley?
Doing great. How about you?
I'm doing great. And you showed up with pizza.
I did.
She's trying to one-up a Sam's
deal. Because I love my boys, and it is Christmas.
And your boys are old pizza veterans, you know? So when the lady shows up with the pizza, our pride might get a little bruised. But we thank you, Shelley.
It was the easiest, bestest thing I could think of.
I mean, after how many years in the pizza world, pizza's my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
You can't go wrong.
If I don't get pizza 2-3 times a week, I feel like I'm not living. So Shelley has hooked us up, and we'll get
around to that.
I probably don't even need to mention it. Wright's Coin Shop is probably slammed this time of year.
They have been totally slammed. But, you know, here it is, Saturday, right before Christmas, and they're already closed. So if you have not done your Christmas shopping yet, you're kind of out of luck.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, people knew this. They had their heads up. And also, Nevermore Mystical Arts has closed its doors.
It's physical doors. Yes, but online. I live forever, 24/7. And I'm excited about this.
And the cyber store, I know the last few days you've been working the bugs out, trying to get it all fine-tuned and everything,
yeah.
But the website, people are going to go ahead and want to jot this down, favorite this in their web browser of choice. The website is
NevermoreMysticalArts.com.
It's a paranormal boutique run by our own Shelley Wright, and it's great. The selection is everything you had in the store and more, right?
Most everything, yes. The really, really super popular things, and I will be changing things pretty often and adding new. I'd like to get more into the one-of-a-kind, limited edition. I'd like to get more of those in there.
Well, if you never set foot in Nevermore Mystical Arts at 1271 Sweeten Creek Road, I can drop the address because it's still pertinent. Because after New Year's, Wright's Coin Shop is going to open at the same address in the same plaza. Because you guys were in a little block building there,
right?
With adjoining doors, basically. Wright's Coin Shop, still a brick and mortar shop.
Still a brick and mortar.
Will be for the foreseeable future.
It will be. And you know, you're still going to see me. You know, every once in a while, you'd see me darting back and forth. I'd be doing paperwork for the coin shop, or I'd have to go over there and use their microwave to heat up my lunch.
So you're going to be back in Wright's Coin Shop in the flesh if people need...
I will hear
people
there.
Need their Shelley fix. If they want to see Shelley, they might be able to catch you at the coin shop.
Oh, yeah. They can still catch me there. And I already know that I'm covering for one of the guys like the third week of April while he's on some kind of cruise. So, oh, yeah, I'll be there.
Okay.
I'm not going anywhere.
You know, folks, usually we save our feature for the second hour, but we're going to jump right into it today because I was lucky enough to line up a special guest, short notice, someone whose knowledge and depth of appreciation for strangeness around Asheville, I mean, it knows no equal. This gentleman came into Joshua's Mystery Museum when it was down on Marjorie Street in the old county jail complex building there.
The spooky
going
one.
Going on 7 years ago, which is hard to believe.
It can't be that long.
It was 2010, right?
I think so.
And anyway, this gentleman strolls in when I'm on the desk there, and you know, it's kind of quiet, tucked away. There were only a special kind of people that ever came into the little museum on Marjorie Street, but it was quite an experiment. And this gentleman strolls in, and we had a effigy of the Duke of Asheville up on the roof at the time. And this gentleman comes in, and we had a little display talking about Sidney Lascelles, a.k.a. the Duke of Asheville. And we've told the story here on the show many times. Allegedly wealthy, influential gentleman shows up in Asheville in ill health about 1904 and soon dies. And when they telegram England to get in touch with his relatives, according to the person he had identified himself as, the folks in England know of no such person. And it turns out that this gentleman was a philanderer and a bigamist and a just a nasty sort of character who, for probably going on 20 years or more, had been up and down the United States marrying and bilking women, wealthy women, out of their money. And he had built up quite a reputation along the way before landing in Asheville shortly before his death. So the Nolan Brown Funeral Parlor down on Church Street mummified him and kept him around waiting for someone to claim him for half a dozen years. And every now and then they would take him out for some fresh air. They would take him out and parade him around downtown Asheville. Can you imagine what the reaction would be if you took a dead body and paraded it around town?
Oh, my gosh. People would just lose it here now. But, you know, when I was growing up, my grandmother used to have this story about how there was an embalmed body that would just stand in the corner and would just watch over people as they were playing poker. So I'm wondering if this was maybe the same guy.
Strange.
I mean, how many embalmed guys...
It could be. You hear all kinds of stories about the Duke of Asheville. One is that when a fellow would come in looking for employment, the guys would say, "You need to talk to the boss. He's up at the top of that staircase in the room up there. Just go up there and tap on the door and walk on in." And guess who? The only person in that room was the Duke. So they said these prospective employees would go up the stairs, tap on the door, walk in, and within a few seconds come tearing back down the stairs, out the door, never to be seen again. So that was your first test. If you wanted to be employed at the funeral parlor, you had to pass the interview with the Duke. And the man who walked into the museum those years ago said, "I've got a little something on this flash drive you want to see." Showed me the first photographs and sketches of Sidney Lascelles, a.k.a. the Duke of Asheville. And that is, without further ado, Scott Lunsford. Scott, yeah, roundabout way of getting you on the microphone, but...
Hey, that's what I do, roundabout.
Sidney Lascelles, certainly a fascinating character.
Superly fascinating. Yeah, he's a great guy, or was a great guy. very interesting. I'm hoping maybe some time to be able to put something, a really good book down. You know, he wrote a book.
Right?
Yeah, he wrote a book, and there's actually one copy of that at a university out in the Midwest.
Right. We got the title page from that. We got those title page in a few of the plates scanned a few years ago.
Yes. I think you showed me those.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. Yeah. Sidney Lascelles wrote a memoir as Walter Beresford, I believe. And the fascinating thing is that memoir was published in a tiny little village where the imprint bears the name of a tiny little village in Wilcox County, Georgia. And my grandfather was born in Rochelle, Wilcox County, Georgia, around the same time as Walter Beresford's private edition of his memoirs was published there. And my great-grandfather would have been sheriff of Wilcox County at the time. I wonder if he knew all about the Duke.
Well, you know, the Duke escaped when he was in prison in Georgia. And they caught him in a house of ill repute in Americus, Georgia.
Okay.
And he was arrested and taken back. And he was such an excellent con man. He had conned the warden and a lot of it. He pretty much had run of the place. And he could go and come as he pleases because he basically took on the garb of as a minister and he got religion and tried to help a lot of people with the religious aspects of their life and time in jail. And then, of course, he gets caught in the
right
in a little little
house of ill repute. He spent some time around Rome, Georgia,
yes,
in those days before going to the state penitentiary in Atlanta.
Yes,
I guess.
I think that's why he ended up in the penitentiary. Was a con that he worked in Rome, Georgia. Got a lot of people convinced that they were going to make a lot of money very fast, and some did. He ran some good pyramid schemes.
Right. Well, Scott Lunsford's a great guest to have in here just to chat, and we could do just that. But I want to let folks out there who are listening know how they can look closer at Scott's work. He's done something that many of us with this penchant for strangeness only dream about. He's gotten books out. He's a novelist. He's a published novelist, folks. And Cop and Coin, Scott, is that your first novel?
That is the first novel. And actually, the Duke is in that novel.
Interesting. Folks can find Cop and Coin online easily enough?
Yes, it's on Amazon.com. And you can also go straight to my website, ScottLunsfordAuthor.com.
ScottLunsfordAuthor.com, or yes, just you Google or Scott, just Scott Lunsford Cop and Coin.
Exactly. And or just enter it into the search engine on Amazon. And I think it's on Prime, so you can get it before Christmas. Maybe.
A lot of real-life Asheville characters sort of populate this novel. But the theme, without spoiling it too much, the theme of it is sort of based around the silver that was paid to Judas when he betrayed Christ, and
yes,
the curse surrounding that silver.
That is correct. And a gentleman on the Buncombe Turnpike at one point decides to make a deal with the devil. And it all incorporates the Jersey devil, the real devil, several homicides that actually occurred in Western North Carolina, and some other strange things that have happened in Western North Carolina, connected with what I say is little pieces of fiction, but you can decide that for yourself.
Interesting. Scott Lunsford is our guest this first hour, and a great guest as well. We'll be talking a little bit more about his novels and how he encounters these strange characters. I sometimes it's like you're not even looking for them, and they kind of sneak up on you. But you're going to want to get your hands on a copy of Cop and Coin by Scott Lunsford. There's your tip of the day, folks. It's going to be a great hour with Mr. Lunsford, and we'll be right back after this break on Speaking of Strange.
Between those trees, nobody seems to know. A flickering fire, a flame in the breeze, leaves fall and rises aglow. A glow. The dancing of torches like birds on a wire, watch as they all fade away. Hovering beacons forged from the fire, or maybe a trick our eyes play. Muddy hills whisper, tales from the past, stories from lives gone before. A slave seeks his master, a search party's path, an ancient race painted for war. I don't care for ghosts, they do nothing for me. Everyone has their own take on the story.
Joshua P. Warren speaking of Strange. I'm your host, Vance Pollock, in the studio, as usual, with Sam and Shelley. We've also got a special guest this hour, Scott Lunsford, author of Cop and Coin. And Scott, you've already got the follow-up novel. The Kindle edition of that one's available, and you've got a proof copy of it there, Cop and Call.
Yes.
Same main character.
Same main characters, same bad guy, but a little different twist on the bad guy. I made him badder. And... still the same strangeness, the unusualness of our community, and bringing that out and showing how wonderful Asheville is as far as being strange.
How wonderfully weird.
Wonderfully weird.
When we met those 7 years or so ago, shortly you sent me some sample chapters of some of the stuff. It seems like one of those... the Duke may have been referenced, and something about the USS Maine, if I recall. Do you remember what that was you were working on then? That's been a while.
Oh, goodness, yes. You know, I had forgotten all about that.
That's not incorporated in these novels.
It's not incorporated in one yet, I'll say that.
But it goes to demonstrate that for some years you've been dabbling at fiction.
Oh, yes.
And... yeah, you can't get away from it. Tell me a little bit about, still the only place I've ever seen this young portrait of Sidney Lascelles.
Yes.
In a uniform, which is probably not an official uniform.
No, it was, you used to be able to go to a tailor and get a military-looking uniform made up. And when he was in New York, he was passing himself off as royalty. And, of course, if you're royalty, you would have a uniform. You would be required probably to be in the military or something along those lines.
Right, some sort of title.
Exactly. And there is a probably one of the first mug books, photographic mug books of bad guys created, was put together by a police sergeant who later became a lieutenant and a captain in the old New York Police Department. And he collected a rogues gallery. And I think that's actually, if you Google that, in New York PD 1900s or 1800s, you can find that. And there is wonderful photographs and his original writings and documentation about the rogues and what they did. And there's some fantastic stories in there. At the time, the Duke was doing what he always did, or what he was good at, flim-flamming the ladies. And by getting introductions into families through the young ladies, or the old ladies, he had access to money. And that was, his goal. And that's how he made his living. He didn't die a rich man. Considering all the money that he had swindled out of people all over for those years, he had a very rich, very expensive lifestyle and very expensive taste.
From what I read, the true story of his upbringing is that his father had been caretaker on a wealthy estate.
Yes.
Growing up, he had learned to emulate the wealthy and the proper people.
Yes. And I... got a hint in some of the writings of who that family was or might have been, and I actually was able to make contact with the surviving relative at this castle that's still in England. They do tours and stuff, and he went and did a we emailed back and forth for about 6 months, and he went through all of their documentation, pay records, looking for something that would possibly indicate who the Duke's daddy was, and he wasn't able to find it. So he was of the opinion that it wasn't his family's estate. So that's why I don't want to say the name of the castle and start rumors going around. But he suggested a couple of other places that it might have been, but he did tell me that I would probably not get as warm a reception on asking them to do the research. They would probably let you go there and oversee you while you went through all those books and papers going back hundreds of years, but they wouldn't do it for you over the phone or by email like this gentleman did. He was a kindred spirit of the strange, and he was incredibly intrigued by the Duke story.
It is a fascinating story. The Duke, folks, we mentioned it a little bit in the first segment, a man apparently wealthy, influential, respected, with a private nurse and doctor, shows up in Asheville, dies a few months later, turns out not to be who he claimed. I think when he died, he had about $5
yes.
to his name. So these caregivers who were here with him in Asheville weren't getting paid. In one account, it says that his private nurse had seized his papers and belongings and was basically holding them for ransom until she could get paid.
And then I believe she took them back to Baltimore, where she came from. She just packed up everything she could and left with it and borrowed money from Asheville, somebody here, in order to get back home. She was literally stranded here.
Oh, my goodness. And even 6 years later, when his mummy, when his remains were claimed, the people responsible for signing for paying Nolan Brown for their services, you know, to basically get the body out of Hawk, and the people who they say most accounts will agree that the body was transported to Washington, D.C. and cremated.
And cremated, and the ashes supposedly
scattered in the Potomac.
And scattered in the Potomac from the bridge.
That's what they say. And the woman who missed another mystery woman, maybe because she just didn't want her name out in the public associated with the Duke, but one of his wives, reportedly, but her attorney here in Asheville, his name appears in the press reports of the day. I never could find any proof that this person exists. So I think here's a person representing one of the former wives of the Duke using an assumed name.
I suspected, and this is just a theory, I thought it was probably a brother or another relative of mm-hmm. hers, and he was trying, or representing her as an attorney, trying to spare her the embarrassment of what was going on, but still she wanted to do the right thing by taking him out of the storefront and getting him buried or taken care of. I don't know if being thrown into the Potomac off a bridge is exactly a good way to eulogize somebody, but
in the newspaper reports of the day, it's interesting in this digital age that you can search and find so many reports. It was everywhere, all
yes.
over the country, this
San Francisco
mystery man, right?
Mexico City, Australia.
Headshots of the mummy published.
Yes.
Photographs
yeah.
of the mummy's head in the newspaper.
Still with his Van Dyke beard.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was kind of cool.
The Duke of Asheville, Joshua P. Warren told me that story some years ago, and it's always been fascinating to me. Every now and then I'll go back and I'll dig a little more and I'll find a newspaper account or another sketch. It's amazing how truth is stranger than fiction. It's almost easier to use the Duke's story as fodder for more fanciful sort of flights of fancy. And Scott Lunsford, our guest this hour, has done that, incorporating true characters and events in fictional novels. And you're going to want to pick up Cop and Coin and keep an eye out for Cop and Call, which the Kindle edition is available.
Yes, it is.
Just Google Scott Lunsford, Cop and Coin.
Cop and Call, and I think you're really going to enjoy this writing because it's got a mix of so much strangeness, the sort of stuff that we love here at Speaking of Strange, with the Asheville connection. Because, face it, this is a weird place. That's why we like it. We'll be right back after the break. Speaking of Strange.
Bring her down.
You know that. People don't usually wander in here by accident. Oh, yeah. Going on for some years now, and another one is almost under our hat. Can you believe that I've been sitting at this table for nearly a year?
That's crazy.
Gosh. This is technically the Christmas episode. I mean, the poinsettias are wilting on the table, leaves... dropping off as we
it's
speak.
It's not technically. It is the Christmas episode.
This is the Christmas episode, yeah. But I'm saying I don't bend over backwards to provide Christmas content. Second hour, I'm going to tangentially, if that's the way you say that, do a little bit of a Christmas theme thing. Because, yeah, it's like the 2 degrees of Christmas. Anyway, you'll see what I'm on about. Just a little teaser there to let you know that I will try to incorporate a little bit of a Christmas theme for my presentation hour two. It's going to be more deep local weird history. And first hour, our interview here with Scott Lunsford, a man who appreciates that sort of thing and actually mixes it up. In the form of some novels, some mystery novels, some crime novels, Cop and Coin. Scott, good reception so far. Have you gotten some positive feedback on this?
Yes, I have. I've gotten some good feedback, and I've taken some of that feedback and applied it to the next book, hoping that more people enjoy the book and enjoy the stories. So that's my main focus.
I know people can find it out there on the internet, Scott Lunsford's Cop and Coin. But are there a couple local places where people can drop by and pick up a hard copy of it?
Oh, yes. You can go by Happy Hill Restaurant on Patton Avenue.
Uh-huh.
Mike's got the copies, and I'm probably going to be dropping off a bunch of them there. And they are autographed and signed by me. And not that makes them any more special, but Mike will fix you up, and I'm always looking for different avenues to sell and tour to get the book out there. Little side note, I'm not making a lot of money off the books. I send the royalties to a orphanage in Haiti, so that some people that are less fortunate, some really wonderful kids, get the benefit of it.
That's amazing. I mean, you write the books because of your passion for the subject matter, and if there are any returns on it, then you donate it to charity. I mean, what a great gesture from Scott Lunsford there. So, yeah, Cop and Coin. Go by a Happy Hill restaurant and pick up an autographed copy of it. I think that's great. Support local. And I know that the folks out at Happy Hill were carrying, like, some other local independently published authors.
Yes, they got some.
That's real nice of them to do that. It's like a down-home, a real local establishment. And
supporting the locals.
I like that. So Happy Hill Restaurants, where you can grab a hard copy of this, autographed by Scott Lunsford. Yeah, very good stuff.
And since it's the Christmas edition today, go on Amazon, buy you a Kindle version, and email it to somebody.
That
last-minute gift out there.
That's right. I know there are people thinking, wow, I didn't know such a thing existed. Well, now you know. You have no excuse not to spread the word and share it. We haven't even mentioned, Scott, that you're retired local law enforcement.
Yes.
You spent many years with the Asheville Police Department.
30 years with Asheville, yes. Or a little longer, I guess.
Gratifying work in some ways?
Yes, very much
so. You're supposed to say that.
Yeah, well, helping the people and working in the community, the people of our community, man, fantastic. And I enjoyed the meeting people and hearing their stories and just helping people out. It sounds corny to say that, but you know that is why people get into law enforcement work, is hopefully to help people, because you don't get a lot of money for it.
And that's another place where Scott and I's interest kind of dovetail, because especially since we were in the old county complex space down there on Marjorie Street a few years ago, when I started doing research and found out about characters like Sheriff John Lyerly and so many others. And then I started looking at fallen officers killed in the line of duty. I wanted to learn their backstory. In a lot of cases around the country, you have departments, they've got a list of officers killed in the line of duty, but they really don't have those stories.
The stories behind the why they died or how they died. And,
right. There's the monument down there next to the courthouse that has, or the plaque at the courthouse that has a list of all these men, but people don't know the stories about Ed McConnell, you know, who was killed by a man when he apprehended him in 1911, and he's taken him back to the station, and the man gets a pistol out from under his shirt and shoots Ed McConnell, and he dies a short time. We don't really see the person. They just become a name on a plaque.
Yes.
And that's what I appreciate, Scott, about the sort of work and research you do.
Well, thank you.
You keep the flesh and blood on these bones, you know.
Well, I try to, and not to keep harping about my books, but I'm going to harp more. In the second book, I talk about a police officer's death that actually occurred in Western North Carolina. And I've tied it into the story. And he was one of the first troopers in our area that was killed. And he died at 20. And he had already been a police officer with the Highway Patrol in North Carolina, as I understand it, for 2 years.
George Penn.
Yes.
The Payne and Turner shooting out in Fairview. I know exactly where George Penn fell and died.
Yes.
It's over there on Webb Creek Road.
Exactly.
Coming off the mountain into Fairview. Yeah. I met a lady by the name of Mary Kirkendall a few years ago, who, she was 16 years old at the time, I believe, but she was standing on her front porch just down Webb Creek Road there and heard the gunshots as the car chase
went by.
That ended.
And, they removed the rear window from the vehicle that was being chased and were shooting at the trooper from through the back of the windshield or through the back of the vehicle, and they basically outgunned the trooper.
The I-40 bridge over 74A there is now Trooper George C. Penn Bridge, named in his honor. And a few years ago, they had a memorial service there. And there were a couple survivors who remember when they were very young. I believe that was in 1937, late 30s, anyway.
And you know, when the two men that did the killing, and when they left Asheville, they kidnapped and took with them two young ladies and released them in Morganton later. And they went all over the place doing robberies and bank robberies and car stealing cars, whatever they needed to do.
Right. Well, Bill Payne and Wash Turner ended up in the gas chamber for the George Penn murder.
Yes. So and the longest death on an execution in North Carolina was Mr. Washington. Turner.
Washington Turner. Yes. How long did that take? It took too long.
I think it was 17 minutes.
Wow. That's
awful. Before the doctor actually declared him dead.
It's 17 minutes in the gas chamber. That's not too good. But Cop and Call references the...
References that particular incident. And I try to give an underlying backstory to the bad guys. So
they say that Trooper Penn haunts the lodge at Lake Lure, not the Lake Lure Inn and Spa. Now a lot of people will say, it's so and so room at the Lake Lure Inn and Spa, but my understanding that it's the lodge on Lake Lure, which was originally built along in the early 30s as a retreat for state troopers.
Yes.
And they say that George Penn would spend his weekends there at the lodge on Lake Lure, and that his ghost haunts the lodge on Lake Lure to this day. So, yeah, George Penn. See, I think that Scott and I, we're still going to do it. We're going to get together one afternoon, and we'll just sit down for a few hours and throw names back and forth. And I bet one or the other of us can elaborate on a lot of these.
Well, we need to collaborate on a book.
Yeah, yes. I agree with that. When you were working on Cop and Coin, you ran across a lot of good stuff that didn't really fit within the confines of the story, and some of that material you've published in sort of as a companion book. This is based on some WPA interviews, is the Works Progress Administration, Depression Era interviews, local history, and things like that. And you've put out a volume called There's Plenty of Good Air and Sunshine.
Yes, that is a quote from my grandmother. While doing some research on for my storyline, trying to find good characters that I can put in, I discovered my grandmother in the National Archives. And that is a line that she uses when she's talking to WPA interviewer.
Fascinating. Scott Lunsford, our guest this hour. We're going to wrap it up after the break. Go online and look up There's Plenty of Good Air and Sunshine. It's a WPA interview from 1938 by W. Stevens, compiled and edited by Scott Lunsford. A lot of local information on there. Well illustrated, Scott. I just have to applaud you for your work and research and dedication to the unusual and neglected history of our region. We'll be right back. Speaking of strange.
I met a big woman with eyes of fury and a voice is hard and stone. She'd get me, couldn't live without me. Said she'd use her mojo bone. Ah! She put the whammy. Oh, yes. Yeah, she put the whammy. Wow! She put the whammy. My mind's in neutral. Oh, she put
upside her head. I said, release me. I ain't lying, woman. Release me. Or I'll blow the moonlight clean through your bald head.
Speaking of strange, winding up our first hour with guest Scott Lunsford. It's gone too quick, Scott. I mean, it always does. We get in here, we start chatting, ping-ponging these ideas about during the break. We started talking about all I have to say is Helen Clevenger, and you know the lights go on. It's like Helen Clevenger, the murder of Helen Clevenger at the Battery Park Hotel in the 1930s is one of the most famous murder mysteries in Asheville history. Again, that one made headlines all around the country.
Oh, yes, it did.
Because a lot of influential, wealthy people were implicated.
Yes.
Before the investigation did a complete about face, and it was almost too clean from then on. They pinned it on a African American hall boy by the name of Martin Moore, and
yes,
just within months, by December of that year, he had been sent to the gas chamber,
yes,
for the murder of Helen Clevenger.
Based on a confession that was obtained by two detectives that came down from New York City at the request of the family to take over the investigation from Sheriff Brown.
It sounds a little bit fishy, and you believe it is.
I believe it is, yes.
Yeah, I smell a rat. When we start looking at that, and that's another explanation behind the hauntings at the Battery Park Hotel.
Oh, yes.
Some sensitives, people who believe in ghosts, say that it's Helen walking the halls trying to plead the case of Martin Moore. You killed the wrong man. You blamed the wrong man. And it does seem that way. If you read the original investigation, there were so many people accused or detained.
The usual suspects were brought in.
Mm.
Yeah.
And then turned loose when they found a hall boy to confess to it after he was beaten with hoses, a confession with bloody fingerprints on it.
Yes.
And it doesn't bode well for the authorities.
No.
The True Detective, have you heard the radio program of it? There's actually a surviving radio program that they made out of the Clevenger case
from True Detective.
It's really rough, but I've got an audio restoration buddy that I would like to clean up that radio broadcast. The Helen Clevenger story as
well. That was the crime of
pages.
The century then. That was the O.J. Simpson of its day.
Yes, it was quite a sensation. And Helen Clevenger found her way into any of your novels yet, Scott?
Not yet.
Maybe our book will have to take up the case of Helen Clevenger.
I think that would be an excellent idea. We could do several chapters on that because there's a lot of information out there, and maybe we can get a pardon.
Would that be something? A posthumous pardon. Stranger things have happened. Cop and Coin, the first novel by Scott Lunsford, available at Happy Hill Restaurant out there on Patton Avenue. Go in there and get you a plate of hash browns and a copy of Cop and Coin, autographed, as a matter of fact. And then Cop and Call, the sequel, is now available in Kindle edition and soon in hard
copy. I'm hoping any day. I'm waiting on my first hard copy to come in the mail so I can make all the checks on it and send it back in. E-digital is so much easier to produce. When you go to paperback or actual handheld text, you have to look at each individual page and go through it, where with an e-book, the computer does a lot of it.
But right. Isn't it kind of just nicer to have a tangible thing in your hands?
Yes.
That you've worked on, and now you're holding it.
Yes, and you can go back and research it instead of having to wait for the computer to warm up. Or where did I put that laptop? No, here it is up on the shelf. I got the book. So, yes, I'm very much into the actual
something I will never have.
Analog. Like,
I could fabricate one. Pretty realistic looking, but
yeah, you could just make a cover.
I would love to just make covers. I'm not an author. I just make book covers. Fake book covers.
Well, Scott, thanks for much for sitting down for us this hour.
Well, thank you for the invite.
ScottLunsfordAuther.com is your website,
yes.
Right? Scott Lunsford, LUNSFORD, ScottLunsfordAuther.com, your website, and Cop and Coin. Looks to be a very great book, and I'll be recommending it on the show and to listeners and friends that I meet in the street for some time to come, I imagine. Any parting thoughts?
I just, if somebody buys the book and they read it and they enjoy it, that's basically what I'm looking for, is people to enjoy it and maybe look at it and see something that strikes their interest, and they go back and research it and find out there might be a little bit of truth in what I wrote, or make them wonder.
All right. Thanks so much, Scott. Speaking of strange, we'll be right back.